Up to you. Good morning. Like Johnny said, my name is Doug Walker. I'm the pastor of students here at the Jennersville campus, which means I get to hang out with middle school students and high school students, and I love doing it. My wife and I have been here for a little over a year, since a year this past October, and we love it. We came from Doylestown, Pennsylvania in Bucks County, and when we were up there, I was working at a church. And what I was doing there was I was helping run the middle school and high school ministry. And this particular moment in this story, I was running the middle school ministry on my own. And we used to do it on Tuesday nights and for 2 hours from 6:30 to 8:30. And we would have about anywhere between 60 and 80 seventh and eighth grade students come, which is just mass chaos. Basically, my job is make sure no one dies. So including myself. And but every Tuesday night we would do that, and I had about 10 volunteers, and it was just a mass chaos of a night. And there was this one time in 2014, on one of these Tuesday nights, I made a really dumb decision. As you do at middle school functions, we're playing dodgeball, because that's what you do with middle school students. So about once a month, we would play dodgeball. So the gist of the night is we would have this large group game for about 30 minutes, go downstairs, have a small game with a couple of students, then teach, and then small groups. And so we're in the very beginning of the night. We're playing dodgeball up in our sanctuary. We've cleared out all the chairs, there's just 80 people in this room playing dodgeball. It's just insane. And kids are crying, and he cheated. No, he didn't. You just are not very good. So, to be honest. So we're playing dodgeball, and I'm not playing. I'm just kind of monitoring and making sure no one's getting hurt and dying. And so, but I'm noticing that the seventh grade team is getting just utterly destroyed by the eighth graders. Embarrassingly so. And so by the third game, they are starting to ask me to play, because everyone knows I'm very good at dodgeball. I am not, but in the eyes of a seventh grade girl, I am amazing at dodgeball, and I'll take it. So they are begging me to come and play with them, so I reluctantly get in the game, and I would always tell my volunteers, hey, this is middle school dodgeball. We're playing at like the most 60%. Do not play 100%. You're not taking your anger out at your job here on eighth grade students, but we're getting destroyed, my team. So I decide, I'm going to go 100%. I'm just going to do this. And so like Rambo style, because at that point, like, I am the only target. As soon as I get into the game, or any adult, you're the only target. You're a one-man show. So Rambo style, I start taking out eighth grade boy after eighth grade boy, and I'm finding myself athletic for the first time in my life, and it feels awesome. And at one point, I found myself going and grabbing a dodgeball. I go down, I pick it up, and an eighth grade student had thrown a ball at me, and so I go to dive. And again, I'm not very athletic. If it's a sport with my hands, I'm out. Like, I'm done. And unfortunately for me, my high school gym teacher hated my favorite sport, which is soccer, and he loved my two worst sports, football and basketball. And so we play that all the time, and I would always break or sprain a finger every single time. So I'm familiar with that pain. I know that pain, okay? And so now we're playing dodgeball, and I'm not athletic in any sense. I pick up the ball, and I'm going to throw it, and some kid throws a ball at me, and I go to dodge. And like super slow-mo, I can see the injury that's about to occur. And I'm making my way down to the floor, and this is like just a concrete floor with a very thin layer of carpet. It's nothing nice. And I have this ball, and if this is the floor, I come down like this, straight down, and just bang my finger on this concrete floor. I immediately know that I've broken my finger. It's excruciating pain. I'm trying to hide it from all the students because I want to be a man and a tough guy. And so I don't want to see them. You know, I'm trying not to cry. And it is immediately just black and blue, disgusting, swollen, awful pain. So I have a choice I have to make. Am I going to finish out the night, the next hour and a half, in this excruciating pain, run another game, teach, run small groups, all that stuff, or am I just going to hand this over to my volunteers and have them finish the night? And we have never prepared for this type of situation where I'd have to leave. Like, we were not ready for this. And so I just say, you know what, I'm going to wait to go to the hospital. I'm going to wait to go to urgent care. I'm going to finish this out. And then afterward, we're going to go to the hospital. And so by the end of the night, it's like 9:30, and I'm exhausted. I get home, and it's around like 9:45, 10 o'clock. And I am so tired, and I'm sitting on the couch looking at this, and I make a decision. And I decide, you know what? I'm just going to wait till tomorrow. I'm just going to wait till tomorrow to fix this thing. And so then tomorrow came and the morning came and then I remembered, I have a meeting I have to go to. So I go to my meeting and then another meeting pops up and you know how all of a sudden your day is gone and suddenly I've gone all day not going to the hospital and my finger just still excruciating. And suddenly a day turns into a week, months. And now about 4 years later, I have not gone to the hospital to get my finger fixed. And to this day, like if I like shake someone's hand in just the right way, or I pick something up in just the right way, I feel this excruciating, this moment of pain in my finger that is just so terrible. And so about a year ago, I was at the doctor's office for an unrelated thing, and I just brought up this story, which he then says, that's pretty stupid. And I go, thank you. I'm aware that it is dumb. Please help me, sir. And he goes, the only way that you can get this fixed now is you're gonna have to have someone break it and reset it. And I'm like, that is great. That's awesome. Thank you. That's great news. I'm going to pay someone to break my finger. Awesome. So now, because I waited, I now experience pain. I put something off, and as a result, I now don't experience my hand the way I'm supposed to experience it. Because I waited, I now experience pain. That's the idea that I want to talk about this morning, this idea of us waiting and missing out on something better, on missing out on something greater. Before we move on, though, I just want to take a quick second and pray together. Father God, we come before you waiting in expectation for your return. God, it's December 31st, and we are waiting in hope and expectation for you to do a good work in us and through us and with us. And God, I pray that you would speak through me this morning on this topic of waiting. God, use me and speak through me, and may we understand our need for you at a deeper level today. Amen. All right, I want to look at a story in the Old Testament about a guy named Naaman. Naaman was a pretty legit guy. He was the commander of an army, and we're going to just start right into this story. He was a commander of an army. Let's see who he was. 2 Kings 5:1. Let's look at it together. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and in high favor because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. So right away, we see that Naaman is a pretty successful guy, and he's successful based on the things that he has accomplished in his own efforts and his own abilities. Because of his skills, because of what he can do, he has gained respect and a good reputation amongst his peers, amongst his friends, and amongst his coworkers and his boss. Because of his hard work and what he's capable of, he has accumulated a good status. He's accumulated good connections. I mean, he has friends in high places. The king is his friend. He's got power, and we're going to see in a second, he's got wealth. Naaman has it all. He's got everything going for him, and it's all a result of his own personal effort and his own personal drive and self-will that he has put himself into this position. But he is a leper. He's got this disease that is incurable. There is no cure for what he has. He can't make himself better. He can't fix himself. There's nothing he can do to get rid of his leprosy. And so his whole life has been dictated by his hard work. His whole life's been dictated by his own personal effort, and it has gotten him very far in life. But now he finds himself in a position where there's something beyond his control that he cannot make right and he cannot fix. Let's keep reading. At this time, Aramean raiders are soldiers from Syria. This is from Naaman's nation. These are guys that work for Naaman, had invaded the land of Israel. So here's kind of the story. At one point, there was a king in Israel, and he was making the people work really, really hard, and there was a really high tax. And so when he had passed away, the people had said, hey, listen, new guy, new king in charge, you better cut our taxes and let us work less, or we're going to be out of here. And the king said, no, you're going to work the same amount. And in fact, the taxes are going to be more. And so the land kind of divided. And now there's two different kingdoms, Israel and Syria. And Naaman is the commander of Syria. And in terms of battles and in terms of wars fought, Syria is the top dog. Syria wins the majority of the battles. And so you could argue that Syria at this point in time is one of the greatest nations in the world. And Naaman is the commander of the greatest nation, of the greatest army in the world. And so now they find themselves, there's a lot of conflict between Israel and Syria. There's conflict, they don't like each other, they're enemies. And so these Aramean Syrian raiders had invaded the land of Israel, and among their captives was a young girl who had been given to Naaman's wife as a maid. So at one point, Naaman and his army go into Israel to do their thing and try to claim victory over them. And as a result, they've taken people as slaves and captives and taken them, and now they work as slaves for free for people in Syria. And amongst them was this little girl. This little girl was kidnapped. She was taken from her family, from her home, from her culture, everything that she loved, that she knew that was good. Her friends, her family, she was taken away. And she works for the very man that was responsible for that. One day the girl said to her mistress, or Naaman's wife, "I wish my master would go to see the prophet in Samaria. He would heal him of his leprosy." So Naaman, I'm sure immediately Naaman's wife went to Naaman and said, "Yo, this, she just said this. You got to go and do this thing." So Naaman told the king what the young girl from Israel had said. "Go and visit the prophet, the king of Aram," or Syria, had told him, "I will send a letter of introduction for you to take to the king of Israel." So he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. So he went. You know, Naaman is incredibly desperate to be cured of his leprosy. Because of his connections, because of his power, because of his money, I am certain that Naaman has been looking for a cure his entire life. He's probably paid a lot of money to a lot of prophets, to a lot of doctors, to a lot of people, trying to get this leprosy to go away. I am certain he has done everything in his power to get rid of it. I mean, why? Because as soon as you and I, as soon as we get a glimmer of feeling sick, the first thing we do is take medicine. The first, like, sign that I might be sick, we immediately try to attack it and try to get rid of it all on our own, right? Before we see a doctor, we just try to medicate ourselves. And so Naaman, I'm certain, as soon as this leprosy had taken his body, I'm sure he was out there trying to find a cure. He's incredibly desperate. Not only that, he is taking the advice from a little girl who is from Israel, his enemy. Like, he has gotten a glimmer of hope, a small glimmer of hope that he may be cured from his leprosy, and he is just like, "I'm out, I'm going, I'm doing whatever this little girl has told me." Imagine that for a second. Imagine you came home from work one day, and you're at the dinner table, and you're stressing out about this problem at work, and you're like, everyone's going to lose their job if you don't fix something, and you're talking about it, and your daughter, 8-year-old daughter, goes, "You know, Dad, if you liquidate the funds, you might save those jobs." And then you would go, "Yes, I will take your advice." Like, that doesn't make any sense. This is Bible times. Like, women weren't taken seriously. They weren't respected. They weren't listened to. And on top of that, this isn't just a woman. This is a little girl telling him about this guy in Samaria, in Israel, that could heal him of his leprosy, do something that no one else can do. His very enemy. And so Naaman doesn't even question. He doesn't even wait. He goes. Not only does he go, I mean, he has to literally go on a journey. This is what it looks like. Now, this map is a modern day map, okay? So things are different, but this is kind of his journey. I mean, he's going from Syria up top down to Israel. All right, that's about 445 miles, and this is on a modern day map. Now, put yourself in the shoes of Naaman. He's walking in a hot, hot desert. Water is hard to find. He's journeying on a horse, and he has some friends with them, and they're going down. There's bandits along the way trying to steal from you. There's bandits trying to kill you. There's wild animals trying to kill you, and you're just trying to survive. So I did some math. I'm not 100% certain if this is completely accurate, but it'll take about 11 days on a horse for Naaman to get where he's going. 11 days. This journey is like us going from West Grove to Sandusky, Ohio. All right. That's kind of how far he's going. All right. So this is kind of a big deal. And he's all going on the advice of a little girl. He's incredibly desperate to be made right and to heal that which he cannot. Naaman has realized that there are things in his life that he cannot control, that he cannot fix, that he cannot make right on his own. That his ability to achieve and earn status in life is not enough. That his self-sufficiency in life is an illusion. That it's not enough. That he cannot control everything. And he is so incredibly desperate that he goes on the advice of a little girl to be made healed and to be made right. Let's continue reading. The letter to the king of Israel said, "With this letter, I present my servant Naaman. I want you to heal him of his leprosy." Now, here is what's weird. This little girl tells Naaman to go to a prophet named Elisha. And so the king of Syria writes a letter to the king of Israel, not the prophet. Now, it's really, really weird. But here's why they did that. At this time, gods were man-made, all right? Gods were man-made, and so gods worked for the king, and prophets worked for the king. And the king would go to a prophet and say, "Hey, I want you to tell the people that they should, like, work harder, and maybe they'll believe you because they're not believing me." And so the prophet would then, because he's paid by the king, he would then go and tell the people whatever the king wanted him to say. So the prophet worked for the king, the gods worked for the king in order to get what the king wanted. And so the king of Syria's understanding of gods and prophets was that you got to go to the highest you can go. Go right to the king, go right to the source, go to the guy that's going to give you what you want. And so the king of Syria writes a letter to the king of Israel to get Naaman what he wants. "With this letter, I present my servant Naaman. I want you to heal him, king of Israel, of his leprosy." When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes in dismay and said, "Am I God that I can give life and take it away? Why is this man asking me to heal someone with leprosy?" Because he knows that the God of Israel, the God that you and I worship, the God that you and I pursue a relationship with is different than every other God in the world. This God doesn't work for the king. He is real. He does not work for us. "Why is this man asking me to heal someone with leprosy?" I can see that he's just trying to pick a fight with me. He's extremely confused about this letter. But when Elisha, the man of God, the prophet, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes in dismay, he sent this message to him. "Why are you so upset? Send Naaman to me and he will learn that there's a true prophet here in Israel, a prophet that doesn't work for the king, a prophet that has been sent by God to speak to the people." So Naaman went. He went with his horses and chariots. He's with a group of friends. They've all journeyed. They've risked their lives down to Israel. They've journeyed together. And now they're with their horses and chariots and they waited at the door of Elisha's house. But Elisha sent a messenger out to him with this message. "Go and wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan River. Then your skin will be restored and you will be healed of your leprosy." Let's continue. "But Naaman was angry and went away, saying, 'I thought he would certainly come out to meet me. I expected him to wave his hand over the leprosy and call on the name of the Lord, his God, and heal me. Doesn't he know who I am? I'm a big deal. I am the king. I am the commander of the army of the greatest nation in the world. How dare this guy not come out and show his face to me? How dare he?" He does not like the way this healing is going to happen. He doesn't like the way that it's going down. How dare he not come to me and talk with me? And in a split second, Naaman goes from being the most desperate man wanting to be fixed to settling and living life with his leprosy. In that moment, he decides, "You know what? I don't need him. I've done life on my own for a long time and it's been pretty good. This leprosy thing, I'm gonna live with it. I'll deal with it on my own." And we're gonna see just why he's so upset. Let's keep reading. He continues by saying, aren't the rivers in Damascus, the Abana and the Pharpar, better than any of the rivers in Israel? These are things in Syria. Why shouldn't I wash in them and be healed? They're much better. So Naaman turned away and went away in a rage. But his officers, these are his friends. These are the guys that have gone into battle with him, gone into war with him. These are the guys living life with him who know him better than anyone else. Tried to reason with him and said, now here is why Naaman is so angry about the way that he's going to be healed. Here is the answer. Sir, if the prophet had told you to do something very difficult, wouldn't you have done it? If he had asked you to do something that required your own personal skills, if he had asked you to do something that you had to earn the healing, if you had to earn favor with him first, wouldn't you have done it? His friends know him really well. His friends know that he has earned everything in his life, and it has gotten him really far in life. It has gotten him the achievement that anyone in life would ever want. It's gotten him all the money in life that he could ever want. It's gotten him the life that he has always wanted. And so his friends say, hey man, we know that if you had to do something really hard to earn this healing, you would have done it. But you don't like the way that this healing is coming to you. And your pride is getting in the way. And you're deciding to wait and live life with this leprosy. Naaman went from being so incredibly desperate to be healed and to be made right, to get rid of the thing that he could not on his own, to in a split second becoming so prideful that he decides, I just rather live life with this thing. In a matter of seconds. Let's continue reading. Sir, if the prophet had told you to do something very difficult, wouldn't you have done it? So you should certainly obey him when he says simply, go and wash and be cured. So Naaman went down to the Jordan River and dipped himself 7 times as the man of God had instructed him, and his skin became as healthy as the skin of a young child, and he was healed. Then Naaman and his entire party went back to find the man of God. They stood before him, and Naaman said, now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. Naaman decides to wait. For a split second before his friends intervene, for a split second there, he decided, you know what? I'd rather live life with leprosy and settle for this life than be made right and be fixed. And I feel like sometimes we do that. We settle for something less when something better is freely offered, but we wait. It's December 31st, which is a big deal. And as I get older, this holiday is a bigger and bigger deal to me. I am not a big New Year's Eve resolution guy. But as I've gotten older, it's become more and more of a thing. And I think it's just become more and more of an excuse for me. Because I'll use that as like, you know what? I'm going to wait to start this new diet till then. I mean, I remember in September, I said to my wife, now this is really funny because, again, I'm not athletic. I said to my wife, I kind of want to get some running shoes because, you know, I used to run every now and then. Like, I'm not a runner, but that was just my way of getting exercise. But my running shoes are pretty terrible right now. They're in terrible shape. So I told my wife, I was like, I kind of want to get new running shoes. And that was in September. And then I made a mental note, you know what? I'll start that January 1st. That'll be my resolution. I give these next couple of months off, then I'll buy the shoes, and then I'll start that thing. We look to New Year's Eve and New Year's Day as this like metaphorical starting gun of when we want to start something. And so we like, you know, maybe it's a new diet or maybe some new habit, or maybe you want to like read a book a month. I don't know what it is. We all have things about us that we go, yeah, there's things about me that I don't like and I want to make better. I want to improve about myself, but maybe I'm just going to wait. And that'll be my resolution, and I'll do it all year. Which, by the way, in like 2 weeks after January 1st, we're not going to be doing our resolutions. Just so you know, that's the stats I've read. But we all have these high hopes, and we look at January 1st as this starting point. And we say, I'm going to do this thing, but I'm going to wait till later. We all have these things that we want to improve about ourselves, make better about ourselves, that we know if we examine ourselves, there's stuff about us that's messed up that we wish didn't exist and we want to fix. And if we're really, truly honest with ourselves, there's things in our hearts and at a soul level that we wish we can make better, but we just can't seem to do it. Maybe your thing is anger, where you feel like, I cannot control my anger, and you take it out on people in your life. Maybe it's coworkers. You take your anger out at coworkers, or you take it out on your spouse or your kids or your loved ones. You just can't seem to get a grip on your anger. Or maybe it's your pride. Maybe you feel like, man, I've achieved a lot in my life, and now I have all the respect of the people in my life, and it's the most important thing to me. And as a result, now you're a workaholic, and so you work all the time neglecting the people in your life, but you can't seem to get over that thing. Or maybe it's lust. Maybe you struggle with lust. And you think to yourself, I struggle with this stuff and I cannot fix myself all on my own. If I'm honest with myself, there are things in my heart at a soul and gut level that I wish were different about me, and I've worked really hard to stop it, but I can't. We settle for so much less when we wait. Jesus wants to know us deeply. And even when we're waiting, he's pursuing us. The cool thing is Naaman waited his whole life to believe in God. But God wasn't waiting for him to believe. God was pursuing him the whole time. There's things about us that we wish were different. There's things about us that we wish we could change, but we feel like, I just can't. I've been trying my whole life. It's out of my control. It feels like it's out of my control. I cannot do it no matter how hard I try. There's healing that is freely offered in a relationship with Jesus. It doesn't mean that once you become a Christian, things automatically change and you become the person that you've always wanted to be. It's a process. Becoming the person that God wants you to be is a process. But there is freedom from your greed, from your selfishness, from your lust, from your anger in a relationship with Jesus. But so often we decide to wait. And I think we wait because we're prideful, just like Naaman was. Because deep down, we are people that are doers. We hate to admit that we need help. We hate to admit that we can't do something on our own. We want to try to do everything all on our own will and self-effort. And maybe if we do that, people will like us more. People will give us their approval. Maybe I'll like myself more. And what we see with the life of Naaman is we have to humble ourselves and admit there's things out of our control that we cannot fix on our own. That only in a relationship with Jesus is that stuff made better, is that stuff made right. I had a friend tell me a story once. He is about 6'4". I'm 6'1", and so I can relate to the story a little bit, but he's 6'4", and he was flying to London, England, and he was flying, you know, coach. And so the legroom on planes is terrible. I'm 6'1", and so like I can relate a little bit. It is not fun to be in a plane. I do not enjoy flying. And so he's 6'4", and so I can only imagine just how much worse it is to fly. And so he has flown coach his whole life, and then at one point he got a free upgrade to first class. Like a 5-hour flight, or I'm not even sure how long of a flight it is to London, but it's 5 hours maybe, at least, I don't know. A long, what is it? 13, okay. I was way off. I guess that makes sense since you're going over an ocean. So 13 hours, he's on this flight and he's going first class. He comes home and he tells me, he goes, Doug, I have experienced the best. I can never fly coach again. It's like you have the absolute best. And now if he ever flies coach, he knows how good it is up there. He knows how amazing it is up there. He's experienced the best. He knows the best. And so for him, flying coach is miserable now. He doesn't ever want to do it again. And I've never flown first class. If you ever want to help me out, I would appreciate that. But I've never flown first class. So I've just looked on the internet at pictures. It looks amazing. In fact, Facebook must know me really well because as I was scrolling on Facebook yesterday, they said, everyone to fly first class? Now you can. I said, what? This is really creepy, Facebook. Anyways, but I've always wanted to do it. So I would look at pictures online just to see how amazing it is. And it is truly incredible. My friend came home and he said, I cannot fly coach ever again because I've experienced the best. But sometimes I feel like we settle for coach in life when first class is freely offered to us because we wait. And when we wait, we miss out on something better. When we wait, we experience a pain that we don't need to experience. The cool thing about this story is it all goes back to a little girl from Israel. She was technically an enemy of Naaman's. And if that was me, if I were in her position working for Naaman, and he had taken me from my home, and he had forced me into slavery to be his maid and to just do his bidding, in no way would I have ever looked at him with compassion and say, I want to help this guy. But that's exactly what the little girl did. She looked at Naaman and said, my heart breaks to see you in a position where you cannot make yourself better, where you cannot make yourself cured of this leprosy. So she extends grace and forgiveness, even though Naaman didn't deserve it, and said, I know how you can be made right. I know how you can be healed. And that's what Jesus does for us. Even though we don't deserve it, even though we haven't earned it, that grace and forgiveness is freely offered to us in relationship with Jesus, but we decide to wait. Who are you in this story? Are you Naaman? Are you in a position that you're so desperate to be made right? Or are you the other part of Naaman who just gives in and says, I'd rather live life with leprosy. I'd rather just settle and experience this pain that I don't need to experience anymore, but I'm just going to live with this life right now. Or maybe you do know the hope of Jesus and you are in a relationship with him. Who is the person in your life that doesn't yet know him? The hope that is freely offered in a relationship with him. His friends in this story are the unsung heroes. They risk their lives to journey from Syria to Israel to get their friend the help and hope that he so badly wanted. They forfeited 11 or more days in the hot sun knowing they could die. And in the darkest moment of the story where Naaman was about to give up, his friend intervened and said, I know you. I know that you don't want this. I know that you desired healing beyond anything else. Do this thing. And as a result, Naaman is healed. Who are the people you're reaching out to? Why are you waiting to reach out to them? Let's pray. Father God, thank you for the story of Naaman, a guy who was incredibly desperate to be made right. And yet at a one-second chance, he decides, I'd rather just live with this thing. And God, I feel like we do the same thing. We settle for something much less when a relationship is freely offered by you, where we experience freedom from all the things that we struggle with, from our anger and from our jealousy and from our selfishness, from our lust, from our greed, from our pride. That is freely offered in a relationship with you, and yet we just accept those things. God, I pray that you would work in our hearts, rid us of our pride, and may we embrace a relationship with you that is not earned, but freely offered. Amen.